I'm Nick Harcourt, and we're here with Moby, and the new album is called These Systems Are Failing. We're going to talk about the record. Remember those? How it came about.
Yep. We're going to talk about the wax cylinder.
And listen to some of the songs as well. And we're, as you were just saying before we started recording, we're sitting outside. We're doing this al fresco.
Yeah. So if you hear helicopters or airplanes or bumblebees or car horns or crazy people yelling in the park, we're basically in Griffith Park doing this interview. So any outdoor sounds, that's what you get when you record outside in
Los
Angeles.
It's authentic. This is an authentic recording outside. Can you hear the wind? I feel the wind. It's nice.
Yeah.
Thanks for chatting to us.
My pleasure.
We've heard the what I guess is the first single, or the emphasis track, as the label probably calls it, which is called Are You Lost in the World Like Me? But we're going to listen to a couple of other songs. But before we get to those, let's get a little bit of context behind the making of the record. It seems like everything you've sort of done before musically has come together in this album, but it also seems like a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about in your activism through the years has also come together in this collection of songs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as time has passed, a few things have happened. One is, and I don't want to indulge in too much hyperbole, but I feel like the world in which we live, and I'm stating the obvious as well, is like teetering on the edge of unspeakable catastrophe. And I sort of feel like if I'm a quasi-public figure and occasionally people are willing to pay attention to me and what I do, I shouldn't waste their time. And I should try and use my musical output, my creative output, both as a vehicle for creativity, but also as a vehicle for activism. You know, so if I'm making a record, I mean, look, I'm a 51-year-old guy making a record at a time when people don't pay attention to records for the most part. So I feel like I should be using that moment, that opportunity to reach people to address some of the issues and causes that are important to me. So I tried to do that in a non-didactic, non-heavy-handed way in the record.
Now, interestingly enough, you've been DJing out a lot the last few years. That's been your main performance outlet, I think, right? You were doing the band thing a while ago, but then you sort of came back to something that you where you began, really. And I'm wondering how performing that way and being back in that culture has informed this record.
Well, it's odd because this record, I was talking to someone a couple weeks ago, and I kind of described the making of this album as being the way that a four-year-old would make breakfast. Meaning, you just grab a whole bunch of things that you like.
All the stuff you like.
And throw them together. It's like a four-year-old would be like, oh, let's make breakfast out of Oreos and dog hair and Matchbox cars. So with this album, there are some dance elements, but it's certainly not a dance record. But it's, you know, some punk rock elements, some post-punk elements, some glam rock elements, some electronic elements. I sort of feel like, as a 51-year-old musician making records at a time when, A, people don't pay attention to albums that much, and B, people certainly don't pay attention to albums made by 51-year-old musicians, I was like, I might as well really enjoy the process of making it. And what's been happening over the last couple of years, and it's one of the reasons why this album is so energetic, is I was, thanks to radio and streaming and what have you, I've been going back and rediscovering a lot of the music that we grew up with. You know, everything from Killing Joke to The Damned to Theater of Hate to The Clash to whatever, even early Psychedelic Furs and XTC. And there was so much energy in that music. And as much as I love what's going on in the world of modern music, what I'm not hearing is energy. I'm hearing a lot of beauty, which is great. I'm hearing a lot of subtlety, which is also great, but I'm not hearing that like passionate intensity. So in making this album, I just thought, you know what? I'm listening to The Damned. I'm listening to Killing Joke. Why not make a passionate, energetic record?
Why don't we take the opportunity now to listen to a song, and then maybe we'll come back and talk about that track. I've picked one if you're okay with this.
Sure.
I think it's the lead off track from the album.
I just feel bad on lovely, nuanced KCSN playing all this like energetic, yelling post-punk music. So I guess that maybe before we actually start playing music, we should issue a little caveat.
Okay.
Is the music we're going to be playing is definitely not nuanced.
Yeah, but you know, the Nick show tends to sort of step out a little bit.
Oh, I know. I listen to it all the time.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I'm thinking, hey, hey. I mean, let's just go okay. right for it, yeah?
And so this, it's just a super energetic, fast, new wave song. And I wish I had something more insightful to say about it. But the reason it's the first song on the record is because every time I listen to it, it makes me happy.
Well, it made me happy when I heard it a little bit earlier on. And I was like, okay, so this sets the tone for the record. Let's listen to it. And then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about the new record from Moby. And this is Hey Hey. I'm Nick Harcourt, and it's 88.5 KCSN, and I'm sitting outside somewhere near Griffith Park on a beautiful afternoon with Moby, and we just heard the kickoff track from the new album. It's called Hey Hey, and yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on in there. Yeah. Where did that track come from? Did the lyrics come first, or did the music come first?
The tempo came first. Basically, I was listening. Do you remember the band Magazine?
I do.
Howard Devoto, who had been in the Buzzcocks, started this band Magazine, and I just sort of rediscovered Magazine and some other post-punk bands from that era. And what I loved about it is they captured the speed and the energy of punk rock, but they gave it a melodic quality. And so basically, I programmed this really fast drum beat and then started playing guitar and synthesizer on top of it, and the song just kind of came together from there.
Before we go any further, I hadn't mentioned this up until now, but the album is actually not released just under Moby. It's Moby and the Void Pacific Choir. Now, I know there's a funny story. There's a story behind this.
I think it's funny. But
and
yeah.
You should tell it rather than me, so let's set that up a little bit.
Okay, so a couple of years ago, I made a record that was very choral. And I went to a studio, I forget what it's called, it's in Hollywood, Pink Floyd used to work there, and I recorded all this new wave choir music, because I really liked the idea of working with a choir. And I was getting ready to release it, and I gave it this name, The Void Pacific Choir. It's based on a D.H. Lawrence quote, because D.H. Lawrence was being interviewed about California, and he said, Californians are content to just do nothing all day and stare at the void Pacific. And I reappropriated that because I thought it was funny, but also on a vaguely more existential level, for the last few thousand years, humans have been wrestling with this idea of what the void is. Like, what is the empty cipher of the universe, and how do we give meaning to it? You know, people give meaning to it with hedonism or asceticism or theology or materialism, but it's all based on the assumption that the void is a malevolent thing. And I really liked the idea of the void being pacific, of it being benign. So I created this Void Pacific Choir, or like a choir of the benign void. But then I scrapped the record because I realized it wasn't very good. And I rewrote the whole record and ended up with this new album, which isn't very choral, but I kept the name because I just thought the name sounded interesting, and it gave me the opportunity to talk about this idea of a non-malevolent void.
Where do you sit on that area of what an artist's role is in culture? Because we've mm-hmm. heard throughout the years that artists should challenge the status quo. And then sometimes you will hear people say, oh, you're just an artist. Just a singer. I don't want to hear what you have to say politically. I mean, where do you sit with that?
I mean, I was raised by activists. And so I was raised with the idea that whatever you do in life, insofar as you can, you should try and make the world a better place. And if you see, I mean, it sounds like almost like superhero stuff, but like if you see injustice, you should try and remedy it and at least draw attention to it. If you see the potential for things to be improved, draw attention to that and try and improve them. And there was a time in the not so distant past where when you released a record, you could think about commercial considerations. You could think about selling records, or you could think about going on tour. But at this point in my life, I don't tour, and I don't expect people to really buy my records. So it begs that question, why make a record? And for me, I make records, I guess, for three reasons. One, I love albums. Like, I grew up with albums, and I love albums. Two, I love being in my studio working on music. And three, it's an opportunity to sort of engage with an audience and try and almost create this dialectic where I put forward my perspective on something and people engage with it. They respond to it. And so there's something really liberating about not having any commercial concerns attached to it.
I was going to say, do you ever second guess yourself because of that?
I mean, I don't think what I'm doing is good. So I second guess myself in terms of quality. Like, I finish the record, I'm like, I don't know, I hope it's good. If it isn't, oops.
But do you second guess yourself on any statement that you feel you might be making through the music or the lyrics?
It's always that question, because I'm an activist first and everything else second. I don't want to be like a one-dimensional, simple activist, because I think to be an activist, you need to look at the issues, but also look at the underlying context, which is the human condition. And so if I want to be a good activist, my criteria for evaluating what I do, whether it's making a record or posting something on Instagram or what have you, is asking myself, have I responsibly and effectively addressed the issues of my activism? But you never know when you're doing it. Like, sometimes I think I've done too little. Sometimes I think I've done too much. But the goal is just every day keep doing what you can.
Let's listen to another song. I'm going to pick the next one, and then I want you to pick the last one, if that's okay. But
okay.
The next one I'd like to listen to is A Simple Love. Tell us a little bit about this song. Can you set it up for us?
Yeah, this is, I'd say, probably the most melodic song on the record. When I first finished the record, not to play favorites, but this was my favorite song on the record. And there is a sort of message to it. Maybe it's subtle, maybe it's not subtle. Is the question of, like, what have we filled our lives with that's unnecessary, that doesn't reflect our values? And, like, how have we wasted our time? How have I wasted my time pursuing, maintaining things that are not worthy of being pursued or maintained? So it's that question. It's a conversation I had a long time ago with an old friend of mine. We were simply asking, on our deathbeds, what do we want to remember? Because it's the one given of life is that we all die, you know, and hopefully we have that opportunity before our death to actually, like, take stock of our lives. And so the question is sort of saying, what am I currently living with that ideally I would be better served living without, materially and spiritually, emotionally, what have you?
I'm going to ask you a couple of follow-up questions on that, but after we listen to the song.
Okay.
So it's Moby and the Void Pacific Choir, and this is from the brand new album, and it's called A Simple Love. It's KCSN. So that's A Simple Love from Moby and the brand new album. And I should tell you now, as we're recording this, we're going to play this day of release, which is today, Friday the 14th.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So
happy Friday the 14th.
Yeah, and happy release day. Isn't it funny how releases have shifted? It used to be Mondays in England, Tuesdays in America, and then now it's pretty much whenever you want it. But I think Friday is sort of the standard day, so you can have new music going into the weekend.
Oh, okay.
I want to follow up on what you were saying before that about... you were talking, it's existential, really, I guess, when you're sort of talking as you get older about, well, what have I done? What have I contributed? What have I wasted?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at with that? How do you feel about what you've achieved up to this point?
I mean, it's funny because when I was growing up, I grew up very, very poor in Connecticut. You know, my mom and I were on food stamps and welfare. And I assumed when I was growing up that if I ever had a record contract, if I ever became a public figure musician and I ever had enough money to pay the rent, I thought I would just be the happiest person in the world. And then as time passed, I got my record deal, I made some money, but my happiness didn't increase, which might be a shortcoming on my part. Maybe there's something fundamentally broken in my brain that prevented me or inhibited me from finding happiness with some small degree of material public success. But over time, I didn't find the happiness through success. So then I had to ask myself, well, where can you find happiness? And I started looking around and asking my friends, asking spiritual people, reading spiritual books and sort of wondering, where does happiness and well-being reside? And I'm still in the process of figuring that out. But for me, and maybe other people are different, I know it doesn't reside in materialism. It doesn't reside in the esteem of strangers online. It doesn't reside in fame necessarily. It resides in perspective and usually very simple things. Like I had this quasi-epiphany, and a lot of my epiphanies are really self-evident, but I had this epiphany the other day. I was hiking in Griffith Park. It was a beautiful day. And I thought to myself, okay, if my last record had sold 10 million copies, how would this experience be any better? Like, how would the wind feel better? How would the sun be warmer? How would the cup of tea I just drank taste better? You know, and people somehow assume that, like, if you have material success, it will qualitatively change your experience of the world, but rarely does it. But yet people still bend over backwards and knock themselves out trying to have material success, even though there's almost no evidence to support the idea that material success actually really improves the quality of people's lives all that much.
Yeah. Some people bend over the other way as well, but that's a whole other thing. Yeah. So, you know, I have to say, though, that I understand what you're saying. And mm-hmm. I think that it's always a good perspective to have, that once you've gotten the success, to understand that it doesn't perhaps fill the holes.
This is the big qualifying variable.
But at the same mm-hmm. time, money sure as hell greases the wheels a little bit, doesn't it?
And that's the thing. Like, I fully understand someone could have just listened to what I just said and discounted it completely, because they could have said, like, oh, but you've made some money, so clearly you're okay. And yes, it's nice to be able to take my friends out to dinner. It's nice to be able to go to sleep at night thinking, like, oh,
the bills are paid.
The bills are paid, sure, this month.
Yeah. And as you said, you grew up with not a lot of money around, so I'm sure you can appreciate those things, and perhaps that is a part of why your spirituality is, you know.
But beyond that, I guess it's that question of, like, does a $5,000 watch tell the time better than a $20 watch?
Of course.
Does, you know, a $30 glass of orange juice at the La Hermitage Hotel taste better than a $5 glass of orange juice with your best friends at your local restaurant? Like, it's that, and I think it's odd that people aren't willing to take a step back and actually ask themselves, like, the things in our lives, are they working? You know, like we're making all this effort to find well-being and happiness, but are the things in our lives delivering well-being and happiness? Which is kind of where the title of the record comes from.
And the title of the record is These Systems Are Failing, and it was created right here in Los Angeles. So before we get to the last track we're going to listen to, you and I first met a number of years ago when you were living in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and you moved here, I think, about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
It's so different from
very,
from
very
New
different.
York.
Yeah.
It's insane. And I've lived on the East Coast as well here. So I know you've talked about this a little bit in other conversations, and we don't need to go into too much detail because of time constraints. But what kind of influence did the cultures that you experience in Los Angeles have on this collection of songs? I mean, what did Los Angeles bring to this music?
Well, and again, I hope this doesn't sound in any way nepotistic or sycophantic. I like using grad student words.
Great words.
But honestly, one of the big influences is public radio.
Mm.
Like, LA has such inspiring public radio.
We love it when you say that, as long as you don't give the call letters of the other stations.
Yeah, I'm going to say it. So, but it's really like, whether it's listening to local programming, non-commercial music programming, NPR, what have you, like there's just, I don't know, a reasonable enthusiasm and humility to public radio in LA especially that I find really comforting and inspiring.
And because we're in a town that is a car culture, people listen to radio so much more than any other city that I've ever lived in. And you do, as you said, you've got the music stations. I heard you recently, and I'll say it, KPCC, a couple of months ago, talking about your book as well. I mean, mm-hmm. there are these outlets, I guess, radio outlets in LA that we don't have anywhere else. But I think
people really pay attention.
They do, and I think I'm thinking beyond that though, because Los Angeles is a confluence of a lot of different cultures. And I'm wondering what impact that has had on you.
And to me, what you just described, that's one of the more challenging aspects of LA, is there isn't readily identifiable cohesion here. You know, most cities, like if you're in London, everything in London reflects and resembles London. Everything in New York reflects New York. Everything in Milan looks like, smells like, feels like Milan. LA, if you're in the mountains, you're in the mountains. If you're at the beach, you're in the beach. If you're in a strip mall, you're in a strip mall. If you're at some billionaire's house, like, it's so incongruous, but it creates a cohesion through that incongruity. And one of my favorite things about Los Angeles, and I don't know if this sounds too weird and esoteric, is how you have access to the non-human here. And what I mean by that is, like, when I lived in New York, from the time I woke up until the time I went to sleep in New York, everything you encountered was human. Buildings made by humans, sidewalks, little tiny parks with a few trees planted by humans. LA, you encounter nature here. And I think there's something really wonderful about having a perspective informed by the non-human. You know, I feel, and I'm going to sound like such a hippie, but I feel like more connected to this, like, like the planetary continuum, you know, like, as opposed to when I lived in New York, you could very easily think like that humans have conquered the world, because they certainly conquered New York. But when I'm in LA, like, there are these mountains, and there are the bobcats, and there are the coyotes, and there are the rattlesnakes, and there are the pine forests and the oaks and the desert, and like, it's so nice to be reminded of an existence that has nothing to do with people.
One more song before we jump out, and I am going to come back and talk about Circle V after this, but okay. Why don't you pick a song for us from the album that we haven't heard, not the single. Let's pick something else.
Okay, it's a very aggressive song, but, and so I apologize to
they'll be fine. They'll be okay. There are a couple of people listening under 60.
Yeah, it's the second song on there. It's called Break Doubt.
Oh, I like that one too. Yeah.
And this is I've been listening to a lot of glam rock lately.
Mm.
You know, Mark Bolan, The Sweet, Slade.
This is like, I was 14 when this stuff was being made.
And there's something, I like the idea of expressing, like, I don't know, a political slogan with a sort of glam rock swagger.
Mm.
So that's the idea behind this song. Is like, how do you, like, why should we leave big dramatic expression to the idiots? You know, like, why do we always have to apologize for our worldview? Like, why can't we be just as, like, forthright as the Tea Party people?
All right. Well, let's listen to it. You're listening to KCSN. We'll come back and we'll wrap up our conversation with Moby. Oh, Nick Harcourt, we're here with Moby, and that was Break Doubt, which is from the new album, These Systems Are Failing. Moby and the Void Pacific Choir, it's actually out today, the day that we're playing this, which is October 14th, but we recorded it a couple of days back. Beautiful day. Thanks for having me over.
Oh, my pleasure.
To your wonderful place. And it was nice that you got rid of all the pool boys and girls before I got here so we could have a serious conversation.
Because yeah, normally there's just like...
It's normally just like so much activity and partying going on here. No, it's beautiful. Thank you. And of course, I'm joking. Let's talk about, before we jump out of here very quickly, this great event that you've got coming up. You decided you were going to curate your own festival. It's called Circle V. It happens, I've got the date here somewhere.
October 23rd.
There you go. So you didn't know when the album was coming out, but
yeah,
you know when this event is. Tell us a little bit about this, because this brings together a lot of things that are very near and dear to you.
So I've been a vegan for 29 years and an animal rights activist for as long as I've been a vegan. And really, that's my life's work.
Let me ask you a question before we jump into that. I am not vegan, but I stopped eating meat 28 years ago. And I have to say that, you know, I'm still alive, obviously, so it's worked so far. But I have to say, I really feel like it's been such a benefit to me as a person getting older, health-wise.
I mean, it's hard. I agree.
I mean, it almost makes up for all the bad stuff that I did.
Yeah, I sometimes, because, I mean... I was a crazy alcoholic for years, and I was touring and not getting any sleep and doing all sorts of bad things, but I can still string sentences together.
But at least you weren't eating meat, yeah.
And I don't look like Gollum.
You don't.
I mean, I should.
No, you don't.
Because I mean,
this is radio, they can't see, but I'm
but I filled my body with toxins for a very long time, and I really think that, like, I mean, I'm vegan for the animals, but I think that the health benefits, the environmental benefits. I mean, there's so many benefits to, at the very least, relying less on animal agriculture.
Sure.
So,
sorry, I interrupted you. But
Circle V, it's a festival at the Fonda Theater on October 23rd. And all the money goes to Mercy for Animals. It's a local farm animal reform organization. And yeah, so I'm performing. It's my only show, my only real show of the tour.
Yep.
One, because I want to benefit Mercy for Animals, and two, I hate touring. Mm. So it's like a win-win situation. I get to like walk to the venue, play a show. It means I don't have to go on tour.
Right.
And Mercy for Animals gets all the money. And Davey Havoc from AFI, his band Black Audio is playing. The band Cold Cave are playing. They're also local like goth rockers.
Uh-huh.
This amazing comedian, Jamie Kilstein. Valida, who's a DJ on one of the other
radio stations,
public stations. And then during the day, we have food trucks and speakers and retail, and Kat Von D is going to be there, and all sorts of other sort of like animal rights luminaries.
Right.
So it's our inaugural festival, and we picked a smallish venue just because it's our inaugural festival.
Because you're going to start out and see how it goes, but hopefully this will be something that will become bigger in the years to come.
I hope so. Yeah. And just to be clear, I think the nighttime tickets are all sold out. There are still some daytime tickets. You don't have to be vegan to come to the festival. I had some people saying like,
not allowed in if you had a burger before you get there.
Yeah, like some...
No burgers.
Some people are saying like, I want to come to your festival and see you, but I can't because I'm not a vegan. I was like, no,
it's
that's
fine.
Okay. Like,
come for the music.
Everyone's welcome.
It's great talking to you. I love the album, and as I said to you before we started rolling, when I heard it a little bit earlier on, I was like, it makes total sense to me, because you and I have had a few conversations over the years, and I know a little bit about your influences from the beginning up until recently, and it seems to me like you've just sort of brought a lot of the stuff that is important to you, both musically and spiritually, together in this album, so congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
It's out today. And it's called These Systems Are Failing. I'm Nick Harcourt, and that was Moby on KCSN.